Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The scene was nothing short of cinematic at Churchill Downs on Saturday. 20 horses running in the 145th Kentucky Derby. Rain falling hard and all those colors, the jockey silks and those fancy hats shining through the gloomy light. The crowd going nuts and the incredible animals pounding through the mud as they fought to the finish line.
Maximum security! Country has 1-2 down to the line! Maximum security wins the Kentucky Derby!
But he didn't. As soon as Maximum Security crossed the finish line, two riders protested, and for the first time in the history of the race, the winner wasn't the winner. This hour on Point, the Kentucky Derby disqualification in a year already full of challenges for the so-called sport of kings. And you can join us. Did you watch the Derby? Were you excited about the finish? What did you think about this disqualification? And more broadly, where do you think things are with the sport of kings? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we will start today in Louisville, Kentucky with Gentry Estes, sports writer at the Louisville Courier-Journal. He was trackside for the race on Saturday, and you could take a look at his reporting through a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Gentry, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
So first of all, just give us your take on kind of the drama and what happened near the finish of the Derby again yesterday. How big was it?
I mean, it was just surreal. You've seen the race, you know, in plenty of times where you see the winner, NBC talks to the jockey, you go to the winner's circle, it's all very standard. It became pretty clear after this one it's going to be a lot different. There was an announcement for everyone, hold your tickets. You had the winning horse and Maximum Security who's hanging out on the track. You have your trainer, your jockey. They're standing right by the winner's circle, and they're unable to go into it. Meanwhile, you have the runner-up horse, Country House, his trainer, jockey, they're standing over on the side, too, uncertain of what's going to happen. The horse is just kind of circling the track, waiting to see. And this thing went on for 22 minutes before a decision was made. I mean, it was excruciating for the people involved. And then, once it was announced that the result had been overturned, there were boos, a lot of unhappy people.
So for folks who don't really know the world of thoroughbred racing that well, I mean, I had to watch the video over and over again before I actually understood what happened. So can you explain to us specifically why Maximum Security got disqualified?
Yeah, in the final turn of the race, basically the rule is written to where horses need to maintain the path they're in. Now, I know that it's chaotic, obviously, especially they're running around out there on a muddy track, and to the idea of an actual lane might sound kind of silly, but there are paths they're going to, especially coming around that turn. And Maximum Security was close to the rail. You could see it live that he drifted away from the rail, and at that moment, there really wasn't a reason why the jockey would have ever wanted to do that. You want to save ground coming around that turn by being closest to the rail, obviously, and the horse suddenly, and for reasons we'll probably never know, got a little scared, it looked like, and decided to drift out away from that rail. Something in the infield, possibly, maybe he saw a light reflected, whatever it was. When he did that, he went into the paths of, well, the first horse being War of Will. There was clear contact made when he did that. He veered out in his way. And really, I think the sport itself was very fortunate that the situation was not a lot worse, because had War of Will been knocked over and lost his balance when their feet got tangled like that, the domino effect with an entire field, 19 horses, and a lot of them behind him, I mean, it could have been catastrophic. It really could have been.
I mean, if I just want to jump in here, Gentry, and sorry for interrupting you, but that's the thing that once I, again, as a very amateur observer, once I understood the intensity of what was happening at the speed that these horses are running. I mean, we should be thankful that both War of Will and War of Will's jockey somehow managed that moment so that it didn't turn into something deadly at the Derby, right?
And it's an indication of just how athletic the horses at that level are that run in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, a horse like War of Will, it was very athletic that he was able to get knocked off balance like that and still be able to maintain his balance and be able to keep running like that. But the contact caused a bit of a chain reaction and affected a couple of other horses. The one horse that really didn't affect that much was Country House, who was kind of on the outside of this. And I think a lot of one of the tougher things for people to understand, Country House continues with a pretty good trip around the track where there wasn't a lot to slow his momentum out of this. So he ends up finishing second. Maximum Security regains his footing, goes on to finish first. And the horse that ends up benefiting from the infraction really wasn't that close to it or that much affected by it as opposed to some of the other horses. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the harder things to understand, because in an objection, they rule a foul on Maximum Security, the first place horse. He gets taken down, and then it's just the way it finished behind him, and that's how Country House ends up winning after finishing second.
Yeah. So, Gentry, one more question for you here. What's the broader implication for horse racing regarding what happened at the Derby here? I mean, Maximum Security isn't going to be in the Preakness now, right? So is there a bigger story here beyond that specific moment at the Derby?
I think so, and I think there probably was anyway in terms of horse racing.
Yeah.
In 2019... There was a rash of horse fatalities at Santa Anita, a very prominent racetrack in California that made national headlines here the last few months. And I don't think it was a positive for horse racing to have controversy on its biggest race, surely. But horse racing is getting a lot more attention than you would normally see. And the attention it's getting in this case could be construed as positive. This was a major sporting event in which the rules, as written, were enforced correctly. They were. It was a foul. It should have been called a foul. You don't always see that in big moments and big sporting events. And in terms of the discussion as it existed with horse racing prior to that, I think to see a situation where a rule clearly meant to enforce the safety of the horses and the riders was enforced correctly, I think that's probably, to me, a positive wrapped around a pretty controversial moment.
Yeah. Well, Gentry Estes, sports writer at the Louisville Courier-Journal, thank you so much for being with us, Gentry.
You bet. Take care.
Let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Hammond, Louisiana. Frank, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been at the Derby 3 times, and I've been at several of the other races. I am just so glad that they took the call and made the right decision. The laws apply to everybody, no matter what the occasion.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for your call. Let's turn now to Randy Moss, who joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's the horse racing analyst for NBC Sports, reported for NBC from Churchill Downs on Saturday at the Kentucky Derby. Randy Moss, welcome to you.
Nice to be here.
So first of all, just respond to what the caller Frank said, that in fact he sees this moment as something good that's happened for horse racing, that the right thing happened at the Derby. What do you think?
Sure, I thought they made the right call, and I thought Gentry described the whole situation very eloquently. Within the sport itself, there is it's not a unanimous opinion about this. I'll say that right off the top. I mean, there are people who look at the running of the Kentucky Derby, people whose opinions that I greatly respect, people who are astute observers of the sport, and they see that Maximum Security was clearly the best horse in the race. And they look and see that, okay, the horses that he interfered with, primarily War of Will, through an objective analysis of the outcome of the race, probably wasn't going to win. Now, that's subjective. I mean, you don't know that for a fact. But from all available evidence, it appears that War of Will was never going to beat Maximum Security.
Right. Well, Randy, so can I just jump in here for a second? Because
sure,
I mean,
sure.
Like, full disclosure, I am not an expert in any way, shape, or form in horse racing, but I'm thinking, you know, in a lot of human sports, the notion is you're only as good as your last mistake. So it doesn't matter how great you are. If you don't, you know, if you don't sink that last free throw, your team still loses anyway. So does that apply in horse racing? Like Maximum Security might have been so-called the best horse on the track, but there's a critical mistake made.
Sure. When stewards look at a race, stewards apply when they're looking at a situation like this, an objection, an inquiry, foul claim, they look at a couple of different things primarily. Number one, they look at the severity of the offense. And number two, they ask themselves, did it affect the outcome of the race? Did the interference impact the outcome of the race? And the fact that this didn't necessarily and probably didn't affect the outcome of the race has caused a lot of people in the sport, including some prominent people like Bob Baffert, the leading horse trainer in America, has come out and said he did not think a disqualification was warranted. But the way I look at it, I mean, there has to be some level at which an offense is ruled serious enough that even the best horse can be disqualified. Do you need to see horses down on the racetrack and jockeys down on the racetrack to disqualify a horse? I mean, there has to be some level at which you say, okay, this is enough. This warrants a disqualification.
Yeah.
And the more when I was on NBC Saturday, trying to fill that whole 22 minutes with replays, when we finally saw the replay angles that were the most dramatic, where War of Will, the horse that was interfered with, where his front legs were actually between the hind legs of Maximum Security.
Yeah.
When it became obvious that it was basically a 50-50 proposition, a coin flip, as to whether War of Will went down or not.
Yeah.
At that point, to me, it became apparent that the disqualification was justified.
Right. I mean, I keep thinking about the disaster that could have happened and fortunately did not. Well, Randy Moss, horse racing analyst for NBC Sports, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about that disqualification at the Kentucky Derby, and the broader question of the already challenging year in the sport of Kings. We will talk about those rash of horse deaths at the Santa Anita racetrack in California when we come back. So I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about that disqualification at the Kentucky Derby and the fact that for the first time in the race's 145-year history, the horse that crossed the finish line first was not the winner. Let's listen to Kentucky's chief state steward, Barbara Borden, explaining why Maximum Security was disqualified at a press conference that was held after the race.
We had a lengthy review of the race. We interviewed affected riders. We determined that the 7 horse drifted out and impacted the progress of number 1, in turn interfering with the 18 and 21. Those horses were all affected, we thought, by the interference. Therefore, we unanimously determined to disqualify number 7.
That's Kentucky's chief state steward, Barbara Borden, after the race. Gary West, co-owner of Maximum Security, told NBC's Today Show on Monday that he saw that foul, but blamed it on the racetrack's greed, saying it was, quote, like a rodeo out there.
I obviously saw the horse move out, but in the Kentucky Derby, where you've got 20 horses, and you shouldn't have 20 horses in the Kentucky Derby, Churchill Downs, because they're a greedy organization, because they can make more money, they're willing to risk horses' lives and people's lives to do that. But yes, I saw the horse move out, but every Kentucky Derby, you could set down 2 or 3 or 4 horses if you wanted to, because it's like a rodeo out there.
That's Gary West, co-owner of Maximum Security. We're joined today by Randy Moss, horse racing analyst for NBC Sports. Joining us now is Jenny Reese. She's with us from Louisville, Kentucky. She's covered horse racing for 35 years for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Recently moved away from that and is now publicity director for the Ellis Park and Kentucky Downs racetracks and the Kentucky Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. Jenny Reese, welcome to you.
Well, welcome, Meghna.
It's really great to have you and Randy. But first of all, Jenny, respond to what Gary West said in that clip we just heard. He's looking at the track itself and calling Churchill Downs a greedy organization because they make more money holding the races the way they did on Saturday.
Well, the fact of the matter is every horse past 14, which is sort of the one main starting gate, it does increase betting for the Kentucky Derby. But as somebody who's been critical at times of Churchill Downs over the years, I got to give them a pass on this one. It is part of the fabric of the Kentucky Derby, the 20 horses. It is what allows owners, more owners and trainers to dream that their horse can get in, a horse such as Bodie Express, who needed a scratch to get in and was right in the thick of things when he got impeded. Country House would not have been in the race had you had only 14 horses. And maybe some people said that would think that was a good thing, the way things turned out. But I just think it would make the Kentucky Derby, just the Ohio Derby or the Iowa Derby or the Pennsylvania Derby, to take away the 20 horses. And what happened, I was actually talking to John Court, who was on Long Range Toddy and was one of the horses really impacted this morning at Churchill Downs. And he was saying, you know, that it was involving like four horses, said that could have been in a 10-horse race. It was unusual, I think, that many horses were so close.
Yeah.
Usually they're a little more strung out at that point of the race. To show you that War of Will finished eighth and only got beat 4.5 lengths for everything. And so for people to say it didn't impact the outcome of the race, you know, it was $600,000 for second. That's no small change. Plus the bettors that maybe had War of Will in there. So I cannot imagine what Gary and Mary West are feeling. I can't imagine that you think you've won the Kentucky Derby and then you haven't won the Kentucky Derby.
Well, so Jenny and Randy, I'm going to turn the same question to you. But Jenny, first of all, as you heard me tell Randy earlier, I'm just going to be completely transparent about this. You're teaching me a lot because I'm not the expert. You guys are the experts. But how much should we look to the decisions that the jockeys were making? I mean, the jockey who was riding Maximum Security, does he bear any responsibility for what happened?
It depends on who you talk to. His trainer, Mark Cassie, would say absolutely not. He was one. He texted me 17 photos every second around the far turn from an NBC, you know, like freeze frame, and he charted the paths off and how Maximum Security just didn't come out, but he went out and he went back in and he went out and back in. And he completely defends Tyler. I also, in talking to John Court, one thing I think that people should realize is not only are these horses amazing athletes, and War of Will's an amazing athlete that he didn't go down, these jockeys are amazing athletes. And as John Court explained to me, he said at some point he had to, and it's instinct and it's split second, he had to worry about making sure Tyler Gafalione on War of Will was safe and give him a little more space instead of riding his horse to get the best position he could get. He said he had to alter instead of going forward. And that's an amazing thing. So it's easy to, you know, I was thinking watching it originally, gee, if Tyler had just stayed on the rail, he'd get that trip that Johnny Velasquez on Code of Honor, who ended up being placed second, just goes up the rail. But he never had that opportunity. He was full of horse. It was tight. And plus, he didn't know which way that the first place finisher, Maximum Security, was going to go.
Yeah.
And
Jenny, he does
commit to the outside, and then this happens.
So let me hear from Randy Moss and what he thinks about this. About the question of the jockey's responsibility.
Well, I understand the frustration of Gary West. I mean, it's unimaginable what it might feel like to suddenly have the Kentucky Derby winner and be celebrating and then have it taken away from you. He has come out and said publicly that he feels that the incident was the fault of War of Will and jockey Tyler Gafalione, which, I mean, all respect in the world to Gary West, but I find that to be a little ludicrous watching the replays. I think that's sort of a Hail Mary he's trying to put up there before his court appeal. My colleague at NBC, Jerry Bailey, Hall of Fame jockey, one of the best jockeys, maybe the best jockey of all time, in watching all these sequence of replays, he feels that Luis Saez, the jockey on Maximum Security, bears at least some fault, some blame for what happened. Now, clearly, the horse was startled by something. He's not talking, so who knows what he saw or heard that spooked him just a little bit and forced him to veer out to his right. My colleague Jerry believes that he probably could have reacted a little more quickly to straighten the horse before he got into the path of War of Will. But that's a judgment call. There are other riders who feel that Saez was completely blameless.
Okay. Well, you know what? We have a lot of callers who want to join us. So let's get them in here. Let's go to Felix, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Felix, you're on the air.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just calling to comment how I believe the disqualification was shameful for the sport, and the best horse did not win. With the jockey clearly doing everything he could, and considering the track, and considering the distance Country House was from the initial incident, I just believe the best horse did not win. Mm. And Luis Saez and Maximum Security will prove to be the best horse in the Belmont, which is the next upcoming race.
Yeah. Well, Felix, thank you for your call. Let's go to Terry, who's calling from Oxford, Ohio. Terry, what do you think?
Hi, Magna. I'm here cleaning stalls in my barn listening to the program. I just want to say that I think it was the right call, but I'm really disappointed in the West. I think they could have handled this with grace and dignity and said, hey, we'll see you at the Preakness. May the best horse win. And the whole thing would have gone blown over and everybody would have been happy and they would have sold a gazillion tickets because everybody would have wanted to see that re-race.
But that's exactly what's not going to happen now, right?
Exactly. And that's why I'm really disappointed in the way the West handled it. I'm in the horse business. I don't race horses, but I breed and show horses. We work all year long, every single day, and we had disappointments left and right. It's just part of the business. It's what we do.
Okay, so Terry, don't go away, because I want to read you a comment that another listener sent us on Facebook. Carl Denham says, the disqualification speaks well of the sport, that officials were willing to make a decision that would not only prove to be immensely unpopular, but is going to negatively impact the Preakness, certainly, and the Belmont, possibly, because it's going to take away any chance of a Triple Crown this year. You would not see that kind of courage amongst officials in the NBA or the NFL. Terry, what do you think about that?
All kinds of horses running in the Preakness and the Belmont that don't have a shot at the Triple Crown. So that's I say raspberries to that.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for your call. And get back to mucking out of those stalls there. Thanks so much. Jenny Reese, what do you think about what Terry said about her disappointment and the reaction from the Wests?
Well, I understand it, but none of us can be in their shoes for that disappointment. But it would have been nice had they said, you know, we'll meet you at Pimlico, let the best horse win, and let the horse prove it. Because what happens, it's one in a million, but what happens if they win their court case? I don't think they can, but it's overturned and they skip the Preakness. And then, you know, maybe you could have. I tell you where I think a lot of the problem came. Here we are 4 days later, we're still debating the call.
Right.
And the stewards had a few minutes to decide this. And I guarantee they probably didn't have all the video angles that, say, NBC had. And maybe Gary knows. I don't think you could share them that quickly. But I understand NBC had like 45 cameras. But the stewards could have done more to be more transparent, explain to the betting public, to explain what exactly happened, who claimed foul, when they claimed foul, why the horse was placed 17th. I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. You have to place the horse that caused the interference behind the last place horse that was impeded. It's unfortunate that the five horses that ended up collecting purse money in this, none of them were impeded. And I think they could have done a lot more. Oh. They should have isolated what the actual incident was, had Travis Stone, the announcer, explain, using one of those little, telestrators that they use on TV, explaining exactly where the foul was. I think the stewards should have taken questions afterwards, instead of reading a statement.
Jenny, can I just ask you a quick question here? Because I want to be sure I understand what you're saying correctly, that perhaps it wasn't so much the disqualification that that's the problem. But the order of finish that was determined afterwards, that the horses could have been chosen to have finished in a different order?
No, once they made the disqualification, they had to, under the racing regulations in Kentucky, they had to place it that way. But I think there could be more transparency. There was a very controversial non-call at the start of the Breeders' Cup Classic a few years ago, where Byron, trained by Bob Baffert, wiped out about half the field, including the other speed horse in the main competition, and he won. But the stewards the next day came up to the press box and answered questions about it. I just think there should have been more information. Having said that, I'm not saying that the stewards, they might have been told, and I do not know this, but they might have been told by, people up above them in the state that, you know, there's probably going to be litigation. Let's don't comment. I think that's unfortunate. I think I'm not saying it makes the call right or wrong. I'm just saying you could diffuse some of the reaction had you had that transparency.
Randy Moss, what do you think about what Jenny's saying?
Oh, there are 3 points I want to make of some of the things I've heard. First of all, the initial caller who expressed his indignation at the disqualification is not wrong when he says that the best horse didn't win. I mean, Country House was put up as the winner by disqualification when clearly Maximum Security was the better horse of the two. Country House wasn't interfered with at all. But again, as I said at the top, there has to be some level of infraction at which you say this warrants a disqualification, even of the best horse. And I think that's what we saw happen in the Kentucky Derby. Secondly, the reason why Maximum Security is not going to run in the Preakness has nothing to do with Gary West's frustration about the horse being disqualified in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, if Maximum Security had won the Kentucky Derby, he almost certainly would head forward to the Preakness in 2 weeks, because that's basically what's expected of the horses, and they have a chance to sweep the Triple Crown. But I don't think Maximum Security was ever going to be considered a candidate to come back so quickly and run in the Preakness had he lost the Kentucky Derby. I think that's something that has nothing to do with Gary West's problem with what transpired. And thirdly, Jenny's point about the stewards, I think, is exactly right on point. I think they made the right call in the disqualification, but the way they handled the administration of it was absolutely terrible. First of all, stewards, when they receive foul claims, if they want to look at something else that they see suspicious that has nothing to do with the foul claims, you're supposed to put up what's called the inquiry sign on the tote board, which tells people, tells bettors around the world, tells national TV audiences, hey, we're looking at this. We're taking a closer look at this. Something may have happened in the race that may warrant a disqualification. They didn't press the button. They left the button completely blank. Then after the race, I mean, not taking any questions, Gary West asked to speak with the stewards and have a sit-down meeting with him. They declined. They said, you've got to come back Thursday when we begin racing again, at which point it would have been too late to appeal to the Kentucky Racing Commission. I mean, the stewards have acted in this whole thing like they have something to hide when they made the right decision. Yeah. They should be much more transparent about what's going on.
This is absolutely fascinating. And Jenny, let me turn back to you here, because we've got great questions coming in all over the place. There's one from Brando Flex, who says, in perfect weather, it would have been a borderline foul. In the terrible conditions they ran in, no way. Why do you think there are more accidents in wet weather? Any video review in any sport that takes over 20 minutes should be a no call.
Well, we don't know how much of that time was discussion or how much of that time was trying to get the appropriate video to look at it. Because I know when I first started looking at some video angles, I'm thinking, well, War of Will really didn't have to check. And the pictures were the ones, that the things at first where you saw the legs entangled.
Exactly.
But the more video you see, you certainly could see that where it did alter, not who was the best horse. Like Randy and the caller said, Maximum Security was absolutely the best horse. But I did ask Bill Mott the next day. I said, if this happens on the first turn, is there a disqualification without a hesitation? He said, no. He said, that's because the horses have the rest of the race, or much of the race, another little less than a mile to react. But at that point where it happened, not only is it a bad place for video because they're kind of changing the angles, but it's where horses are really starting to make that final move if they are good enough and if they have enough energy left, and you can't recover from that. But that's one thing that comes into play here. I think frustration with horse players is this is in just about every racing jurisdiction is a frustration with the inconsistency of what's called interference one day and what's not called interference. If it's against the reg, why wouldn't it be called on the first turn? But there's a lot in the Derby that probably could have been called in the past that wasn't. That's why I think this gets in a lot of people's craw.
Well,
not that it was the wrong call.
Jenny Reese and Randy Moss, hang on here for just a second. We do have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want to talk about some other issues in horse racing this year and the bigger picture of sort of where the sport is. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about that Kentucky Derby disqualification and also about larger issues in horse racing now. I'm joined today by Jenny Reese. She once covered, in fact, for 35 years, she covered horse racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal. She's now publicity director for the Ellis Park and Kentucky Downs Racetracks and the Kentucky Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association. Randy Moss is also with us. He's the horse racing analyst for NBC Sports. Let's go right back to the calls. Karen is calling from Lockport, New York. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. Regarding Santa Anita and all the breakdowns that they had there in the past couple of months, I want to point out that other tracks, Churchill Downs and Aqueduct and Belmont, tracks that necessarily don't have a racing schedule right now but are being used for training, have also had high rates of breakdowns at the same time period. And I think what it all boils down to is not the racing surface, the weather, anything else, but the age of the horses. Horses are not physically mature until they're about six. So you're basically asking a kid to do an adult physical labor. And their growth plates aren't done growing, their bones aren't done growing, the soft tissues aren't done growing. So is it any wonder you're stressing this growing animal physically and probably mentally too, which is probably why you hear about so many of these racehorses being hard to handle. They're so kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, Karen, let me take it back from you there, but I very much appreciate your call. And Karen referenced what's been happening, what happened this year at the Santa Anita racetrack in California. 22 horses have died there this season. And so here's a clip of a horse trainer and the director of the University of Kentucky's Agricultural Equine Programs. He spoke to ABC affiliate KABC in California in March about the deaths.
We love these animals. We don't send them out there thinking something bad's going to happen. And it's stressful.
This is unusual. It does happen. It's called statistical clustering, but we always take it seriously because, again, you know, I mean, we can't do this. You know, this is not an acceptable number of catastrophic injuries.
So the two voices you heard there were Bob Baffert and Mick Peterson. Randy Moss, so 22 horses dying in one season at a racetrack sounds extraordinary. What has happened there?
It's a very complex situation, but I think when you look at what happened just at Santa Anita, and you take Santa Anita separately from other racetracks around the country, and you look at that track during that period of time, which was mainly from late December when they opened until March, and you look, okay, what changed during that period of time? Because in calendar year 2018, the rate of horse deaths had gone down fairly substantially, and then all of a sudden there's a huge spike. Well, it just happened to coincide with what was one of, if not the rainiest winter in Southern California history. And the racing surface that the horses are running over at Santa Anita is designed, because of the location of the track in Arcadia, California, suburban Los Angeles, for Southern California weather, mm-hmm. for sunny Southern California sunshine. And then all of a sudden they're inundated with this amazing amount of rain. And that impacted the racing surface and unfortunately made the racing surface more unsafe for the horses. Now, Santa Anita didn't know as this was happening. They didn't know exactly if this was statistical clustering, as the one guy spoke about, or if this was indeed an issue with the weather and the racetrack. And as the breakdowns continued to happen, at one point, Santa Anita in early March said, okay, we're going to just stop racing.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They stopped racing for about a three-week period. Once the weather straightened up, the rain stopped, they had a chance to examine the racetrack, make a few changes to the racetrack surface. It's cleared up completely.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't issues with thoroughbred racing that need to be addressed to improve, to make sure that every precaution is taken to ensure the safety of the horses. Yeah. That's something that's now a nationwide conversation in horse racing. And frankly, it's a good conversation. And in today's society, where animal rights is more of a high-profile topic than ever before, it's something that the thoroughbred industry needs to take very, very seriously.
Well, Jenny Reese, let me get your take on that, because you heard our caller a couple of minutes ago saying that one of her fundamental objections right now is that where horses are running who haven't reached the level of maturity for the kinds of races they're being asked to run or told to run. I mean, is there a fundamental problem here?
Well, actually, with all due respect to the caller, science shows that being in training and racing at True actually is helpful. It helps with the remodeling of the bones and stuff. And I know this from firsthand experience that you take a horse that my husband trains, and that was not in training at 2. They didn't believe in that. Put in training at 3, the horse finally made it to the races late in her 4-year-old year. They not only experience the issues of older horses, they start to experience the issues that young horses can go through, you know, what they call buck shins, basically shin splints and stuff. So I don't really think it's that. One thing I will say is that, as Randy said, there's many factors in any time a horse suffers a serious injury. One thing that I'm concerned about, and I think does not get discussed, is the increasing lack of horsemanship throughout the industry in a lot of areas. People don't want to pay their dues, learn from the bottom up like maybe they did in the day. My concern is little problems become big problems. I'm not saying that's what happened in all these cases, but when the weather's bad, you don't have to send the horse to the track. You could just jog him under the track in the shed row. And again, I'm not trying to point any fingers about why the horses at Santa Anita died, of which a good number of them were actually on the turf course and were in training. But I just think that maybe it needs to be a little harder to get a trainer's license. And if you had more people that were willing to pay their dues, and I think this is an American phenomenon. I see it in journalism. People don't want to pay their dues. They just want to immediately be a columnist without being a beat reporter. So I think maybe, you know, we need to take a look at that and see how, so people know. So the grooms, the assistant trainers, everybody. And you also have these large outfits. A lot of times the trainer's not around.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find help that is really good and knowledgeable and knows what they're looking at. So that's an aside. I was just texted by a colleague listening to the show pointing out that Belmont, you know, New York has had its lowest fatality rates in decades. Saratoga was 0.97 for 2018. Belmont's was way below the national average. Racing's taking this very seriously, and I'm not sure the industry gets enough credit for the things they are doing. Racetrack surfaces is one of that you have to take, really take a hard look at. And like Randy mentioned, those rains, but, you know, so...
Well, so Jenny, let me just jump in here and turn back to Randy, because I appreciate, Jenny, you bringing up sort of the reduction in fatalities at other tracks. It just makes me wonder, at Randy, though, if you, as we were talking about we had a track that's designed for hot, dry weather. Why didn't they close it sooner when there was all this unusual weather? And, you had the beginning of the fatalities versus 22 horses having to die before they closed it down.
Sure. Believe me, if they had any idea that these fatalities were going to continue, that's exactly what they would have done. And in no way did they want to be part of the firestorm that Santa Anita wound up finding itself right in the middle of. During this spate of injuries, they called in some of the world's foremost experts in racing surfaces, had them examine the racing surface. They were told that the racing surface was just fine. There was nothing wrong with it. So they went ahead and continued the race meeting, and the breakdowns continued. So, they tried to take some precautions. I think they would say right now, if you ask them, were you mistaken? Should you have stopped racing earlier? In hindsight, looking at what happened, they would probably say yes. But when they're in the middle of it, they took precautions. They thought they were sufficient, but as it turned out, they weren't.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to our callers. Doug is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to bring up one point. I've been doing this just about all my life. I started on the racetrack with Frank Whiteley and David Whiteley back in the day. And I think that a lot of these breakdowns should, part of the blame needs to go on the breeders. Back in the day, it wasn't unusual to see races going 2 miles, 2 1/4. The Discovery at Aqueduct, a mile and a half race on an average everyday card was not unusual. But then they started breeding to sell as opposed to breeding to race. And I think that they started to breed a lot of the soundness out of these horses. They bred for speed. Now, if a 2-year-old in training can go down there an eighth of a mile and 10 and change, they're all over it. And they're paying millions of dollars for them. But, can they get a distance of ground and can they stay sound for more than 2 years? Randy, I'm sure you have an opinion on that.
Yeah. Doug, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Randy.
I think it's a very, very good point, and it's something that's been talked about for a long time. You go back decades and decades in the sport, and the sport was basically ruled by aristocratic families who owned breeding farms in Kentucky, who raised their own horses, who then had their own racing stables. And they were, they were breeding horses to run themselves. Now, those families have, for the most part, died out. There's only a couple that are still in business. And now the sport ownership of horse racing is populated to a large extent by people who buy horses at auction. They buy horses at yearling sales, meaning 1-year-old horses, or they buy them when they're age 2. And what this has created is an entire industry of breeding farms that breed with one objective, and that is to get the highest amount possible for their horses when they put them at auction, without really any sort of commitment to how long the horse can remain in training. They're breeding for speed, they're breeding for precociousness, they're breeding for attractiveness, but not necessarily breeding for durability. And I think that has changed the equation in terms of the overall structural soundness of the modern thoroughbred.
I want to get another call in here. Susan is calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling as a WYSO listener. And my experience is taking thoroughbreds off the track and rehoming them and making sure that they could have second careers. There's been a lot of changes in the industry, as Randy pointed out. The breeding of the horses is out of control. There's no limit to the number of horses that are bred. There's no thought of, are they going to race? Are they going to stay sound? What's going to happen to them? We just had a situation last week where an entire crop of California thoroughbreds from a known breeder wound up in a kill pen from a known kill buyer. These horses are slaughtered for meat. They're never thought about again. I spent 45, 50 minutes listening to everyone, kvetch over the Kentucky Derby, 2 minutes of racing a year. And not one single person has talked about what happens to the thoroughbreds who don't make it to the Kentucky Derby?
Yeah.
What happens to the thoroughbreds who have no second career? Because when they were raced to the point of breakdowns, and maybe they weren't euthanized on the track, but when they were finally given a chance to do something else in their lives, they have no value.
Mm-hmm.
They have no value because the physical conditioning is zero. Now, and you're talking about the Super Bowl of racing. So my entire Facebook has been taken over by people, you know, worried and concerned and with opinions about the Kentucky Derby. But there's no conversation whatsoever about thoroughbred aftercare,
right,
and what the industry is doing to protect its athletes overall from the beginning, from the breeding shed until they hopefully wind up in second careers with people like me who grew up with sport horses as thoroughbreds,
yeah,
who understand, you know, that they're incredible athletes, that they're very sensitive, that they're the best sport horses in the world.
Well, Susan, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call, because you've brought us to a fundamental point here that should undergird this entire conversation. And Jenny Reese, let me turn back to you. What's your response to Susan's basic critique about how the sport as a whole treats its athletes, its stars, its animals?
Well, I'll say it in fairness to this show, we had one conversation, one topic. We could let's come back and do another show on what Susan's point, which is a very good point. The industry really has made great strides. And one of the things that all segments came together was the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance. And it accredits rehab and retirement and rehoming adoption facilities, and it makes sure those horses are going to get good care, and then it raises money and funds them. And it's funded by, you know, people selling horses, buying horses, owners of horses when they per start, the racetracks, pretty much everybody in the industry. But it's a race without a finish line. Until every horse has a home, as Susan says, a good home, a safe home, when it's through racing, then you cannot declare victory. But more and more efforts are being made. And thoroughbreds, as she knows, make fantastic second career off-the-track thoroughbreds competitors. And it could be they're just a riding horse. It could be they're a lawn ornament. But there are a lot of people that can get a lot of pleasure from these amazing animals. But the industry is making progress on this.
Mm.
It can just be hard to change in any industry. Look at the NFL with concussion protocols and stuff. Racing has its challenges, but the people that think that they're not trying to correct those challenges, I think, are being unfair.
Well,
20 to 30 years ago, Magna, you never heard anything about thoroughbred aftercare. You never heard anything about an organization that was dedicated to finding second careers for horses and good homes for horses after their racing careers. Now there are all sorts of organizations that are dedicated to that. Could the sport do better? Yes. Could it do better in making sure that the horses that run are 100% sound and able to run as healthy horses? Yes. But as far as the thoroughbred aftercare, there are steps in the right direction that are being taken.
Well, Randy Moss, horse racing analyst for NBC Sports, with us today from St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you so much for being with us. And Jenny Reese, she covered horse racing for 35 years for the Louisville Courier-Journal. She's now publicity director for the Ellis Park and Kentucky Downs racetracks, with us from Louisville, Kentucky. Jenny Reese, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.